All right. Good morning, early afternoon, everybody. My name is Jamie Tomasello. I'm the Manager of Investigations and Development for Internet Law Group. We're a boutique law firm that specializes in pretty much going after cyber fraudsters in the anti-spam, anti-fraud, phishing, any type of cyber crime arena. So we do civil litigation, investigations, and criminal referrals where appropriate. So what I'm pretty much talking about today is some case studies of notorious spammers. Right now, we've seen a bit of a change in what spam was, what it is. Several years ago, it was these marketers trying to send out mail. Now it's a little bit different. So let me move in that direction. So what is spam? How many of you guys here work in IT? How many guys and girls? How many of you work specifically on an anti-spam platform or investigations or enforcement? Okay, awesome. According to a major ISP in 2006, this particular ISP blocked 70 to 80% of the email traffic that attempted to pass into their network because it came from IP addresses that had a history of sending spam. These IP addresses were on known block lists. They were known on Spam House, different things like that. Of the email that got past the filters, this particular ISP still received 7 to 10 million complaints each day regarding spam. Those are specifically from their customers. So it's still a problem. There was a Pew study, a Pew Internet Society study recently that came out in 2007 that said that people are, your average user is receiving more spam than they used to, but it's to them less of a problem. And I think that perception is because ISPs are doing a better job filtering, ISPs are doing a better job blocking. And the end customer doesn't see it. It doesn't bother them as much. So, hold on one second. Oh, well, no problem. What is spam? If anybody was here in a previous, at the previous session, somebody was talking about the Canned Spam Act that made spamming illegal. Canned spam doesn't actually define spam. It defines a commercial electronic email message. It defines transactional and relationship messages, but it doesn't say spam is this. It doesn't even define bulk. Most of us know spam as unsolicited bulk email, UBE, or unsolicited commercial email, UCE. None of those terms are defined in canned spam. Canned spam pretty much set the ground rules for marketers. It said, those who mail responsibly, according to the regulations that we've laid out, you step to one side. Those of you that aren't going to obey those rules and regulations, or you're just doing it strictly, you're strictly negligent, you're on the other side. That's really what canned spam is there for. Let me back up here. So canned spam breaks down into the prohibition of false or misleading header information, prohibition of deceptive subject headings, inclusion of return address or comparable mechanism in commercial electronic email, prohibition of transmission of commercial electronic mail after objection, inclusion of identifier opt-out and physical address in commercial email, and then there are the aggravated violations. Anybody here know what canned spam stands for? Prizes, if you do. Take a guess. No? Okay. It's controlling, that means I get these Red Bull. Controlling the Assault of Non-Solicited Pornography and Marketing Act. So this was pretty much targeted towards the porn spam, the most offensive spam that people were receiving. It wasn't really for the human growth hormone. It wasn't really about the erectile dysfunction drugs. It was, let's stop getting donkey porn in our mailboxes. And that's what really infuriated consumers and Congress. So aggravated violations related to commercial electronic email. If you've not followed the previous regulations, these things will aggravate your violation. So address harvesting and dictionary attacks automated creation of multiple electronic email accounts, relay or transmission through unauthorized access. There's a current lawsuit that our firm is working on. It's Project Honeypot versus John Doe's. It's filed in the Eastern District of Virginia. That particular case focuses on address harvesting, dictionary attacks, and pretty much obtaining email addresses inappropriately and sending spam. So it's addressing the aggravated violations as well as the standard violations. So also, can spam require you to place warning labels on commercial electronic email or electronic mail containing sexually oriented material? So to prevent children, you know, to allow parents to filter out the pornographic material from hitting their children. Now, my personal definition of what spam is, it's unsolicited bulk email. Bulk is defined to me as more than one. Not necessarily more than one email I received, but that the email is intended to be delivered to more than one recipient. And it's the intent to deliver. That's really the key thing to think about, because you've got blocking in places. There are different honeypots that are out there that are catching this email. So it's not actually being delivered, but there was an attempt to deliver. So that traffic is out there, and the ISPs or the filter companies or whatever's in place is still seeing that traffic. They still have to deal with that bandwidth and storage and devote people to it. That ISP that I had referred to earlier that has that's blocking 70% to 80% has 30 full-time people working on spam. That's how big of a problem it is. Now, Title 18, Section 1037 of the U.S. Code, 18-1030 is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Some people may be aware of that or not. But 1037 specifically talks about fraud through email. And it doesn't define bulk either. Nothing is defining bulk. But it defines multiple, which is more than 100 electronic mail messages in a 24-hour period, more than 1,000 electronic messages in 30 days, and more than 10,000 in a one-year period. And what I'm about to show you is that more than 10,000 in 1 year period is nothing. These people send out a considerable amount of mail in that one day. Yes?
What about a botnet that sends out like 10 messages per bot?
Oh, well, that would still, if you were able, and this is one of the things I'm going to talk about in a panel tomorrow about fraud and cybercrime, but botnets would fall under this because they're sending a huge amount of spam. It's compromised machines.
But if each one, a large network, sends out just a few, then I wonder if that technically
gets... It still counts. Yeah. It's still... And because they're either renting... They either compromise that particular set of bots, that bot or that botnet's being rented for that purpose.
Oh, okay.
So it's ultimately the person who's in control of that botnet or sends those initial commands, you still know that that spam run, even if it is distributed across millions of computers, the intent was to send those messages to multiple recipients.
Besides, acting as a single machine, right?
I'm sorry?
A botnet is a single device, really.
Yeah. Just a lot of machines.
Right.
So, you know, you can take it either way. But it still falls under Can Spam, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, individual laws, depending on the state. Virginia has one of the most toughest, one of the most strong anti-spam laws, which is the Virginia Computer Crimes. It's pretty much the equivalent to the Computer Crimes Act, and we've been able to put somebody away for that. Profile of your average spammer. They're male most of the time. I mean, there's probably female spammers out there, and this is not... the sweatshop spam, this isn't really counting the sweatshop spam that's coming out of foreign, like India and China and things like that. But your average spammer who's running a spamming operation, male, 16 to 35, living at or working from home, a lot of times from their parents' basement. Many have not completed high school or college. They're often self-taught. They tend to be loners, but try to have... either their own personality is very outgoing, and they're a loner at the same time. It's a very odd thing. They have an alternate persona, and this activity enables them to have that persona if they didn't have it to begin with. So if they were picked on in school and they have this sort of their core personality, but then they get into this criminal activity and they feel empowered, and they create sort of like this alternate persona, which is big and bad, and nobody can catch them. They usually have a history of other criminal activity, credit card fraud, multi-level marketing. Somebody who was recently tried and caught and for phishing, Jeffrey Gooden out of California, had a history of physical credit card fraud. And he lived in his mom's house as well. One of the other things about spammers is the older spammers tend to either have a history of some sort of petty theft or fraud, and they also have a history of bankruptcy. So you don't know if they're trying to at some time have been in a legitimate marketer or a legitimate businessman, and they got fed up with doing things the right way and decided there's a way to make money fast, and this is it. So Jeremy Janes, he is the first person to have been sent to jail strictly on spam. He was a Spam House Roxo listed spammer, Roxo being a registry of known spamming operations. His alias was Gavin Stubberfield. At the time, he was 30 and resident of Raleigh. He was tried with his sister Jessica and with a co-conspirator, Richard Rakowski. He had sent in July of 2003, on 3 days alone, he sent over 10,000 pieces of spam. Totally, they say that he probably sent in that month several million pieces of spam, but because of the way the law is structured, you don't need to prove it all. If you can prove it for that individual day, it's more than enough. The Computer Crimes Act, it says, with the intent to falsify and forge. It's all the interesting legal data there. But what's most important here is it's a Class 6 felony in the state of Virginia. If there's 10,000 attempted, not actually received, recipients over 1 day, 24-hour period, 100,000 attempted recipients over 30 days, or 1 million attempted over 1 year, it's 1 year to 5 years in prison and a $2,500 or $2,500 fine. Per spam run. Yeah, so per run. So you could look at multiple counts. He was arrested. His house was searched. Evidence was seized. The feds came in. That's his house in Raleigh. I apologize for the pictures, but this was the spam office that was operating in a spare bedroom. This wasn't his house he was living in. This was a condo that was rented pretty much just to do business. So this is just one of his properties, one of his assets. This was the rack mount in the spare bedroom. How they find his computer? Well, and that's one of the things that we specialize in. People make a lot of mistakes. You think, oh, well, they could be anonymous. They were using aliases. But the problem is that these cyber criminals cannot lie uniquely all of the time. So he was using the same aliases when he was registering domain names to send the spam or that to advertise his products to make sales. He was using certain aliases when he was applying for IP space. And after a while, you start gathering that information. You identify who these entities are. Through the civil litigation, you're able to send subpoenas. You know, you file a John Doe lawsuit or you forward it on to criminal authorities. And, you know, they're able to issue subpoenas that will give the identity and the billing information. And after a while, he didn't use compromised credit cards like a lot of the Russian spammers or Eastern European spammers and phishers are using right now. But even with those, they can't always use unique cards every time or unique IP addresses. It's amazing how, you know, with all these anonymizing utilities and these botnets, how many times they forget and log on to a personal account or sign up for something as simple as Barnes & Noble and start to actually receive their to cash out their cards, you know, like, oh, I want to buy some sort of product. And then you see that email from Barnes & Noble shows up in this drop email box. You send a subpoena to Barnes & Noble or to whatever online retailer, and they tell you where they ship the product. So now you know where they live. I mean, they're not always the brightest, but in these individual, these smaller spam operations, you see a lot of these small mistakes. The computer, what they actually seized, they seized laptops, servers, contents. Contents were recovered from the actual servers and the laptops and everything. He had email and not only did he have email address lists of recipients, but he had anti-spammer address lists. So he could scrub his lists. So no anti-spammers, people who may associate themselves with Spam House or other known investigators. Our names are around there. They scrubbed the list so that we didn't actually receive the emails as an end user. So let's say they spammed all of Earthlink subscribers. Well, if one of us happened to be an Earthlink subscriber and they knew our email addresses, they scrubbed it so we didn't get the spam, but anybody else could have. In this particular case, those CDs contained both usernames and full email addresses of 176 million full email addresses and over 1.3 billion usernames. So he had a large list to send the spam to. Anyone know what this is a shot of? Free, you can win something if you know. You take a guess. Yeah, it's kind of hard to see, but let me forward to a slide that gives you a little bit more information. It is RoboMail 2.10.13. They literally walked in to seize his computers while he was running a spam run. And in this particular case, this is the list file, the body file. So you can see that was S3. This is the actual email that was found on the seized computer. And this was sending out S3. It was intended to send out to 5.5 million, and it was pretty successful. It hit, 99.97. And so they caught him in the middle, spam us, interrupt us, in the middle of spamming. So there's the email text that was seized from the computer. That's an email sample from Report Spam. They actually received spam from their the ISP received spam from their consumers, and that's the sample, and here's the actual text that was on the computer, so you can see that it's the same. And these are the actual exhibits from the court case, so... Yeah, that was a... it was pretty much a spy sweeper. It would try to get spyware off your computers. These are actual notes that were recovered from the trash can. If you're a spammer, I don't know if any of you are engaging in illegal activity. But if by chance you are, I would not advise you to write in-depth notes of how you run your business and throw them in your trash can for two reasons. In case, A, you have the feds come in and knock down your door and, take their trash because they can. Or I wouldn't advise you to throw them away because a lot of times private investigators are involved. And they do trash dives or trash pickups all the time.
Was that taken from the street? Or was that taken
from the house? This was from the office. So when the feds came in and took the computers, they also took the trash. They took every type of electronic storage media possible. It's surprising. There are several child pornography cases where they take their child pornography and put it on their iPods and expect the feds not to seize the iPod because they're thinking that's a music device, not a this wasn't a video iPod, so it wasn't showing images. They weren't thinking that it was an electronic storage device. But lately, law enforcement has become a little bit more knowledgeable, and they grab anything that could store media. They'll grab your Xbox. They'll grab your cell phone. They'll take any spare SIM cards. So they're becoming more and more knowledgeable. So here's some details. So that previous one you saw, that had all the information. Here's the stuff that was redacted, but it was still admitted to evidence and shown to a jury. Here's a particular close-up. We were talking about his sister, Jessica. It says, Jessica downloads complaints. Jessica has all data showing erroneous undeliverables, removes, randomizes, and seeds them, and then uploads lists. Jessica creates different ads for Hotmail, AOL, and mixed ISPs. Jessica starts the mailing. Jessica collects all the different leads and then sends them follow-up messages. So I totally would not advise you to make these notes. And then this is what was entered into evidence. The thing that was actually redacted is the name Jessica, which is his sister who was also tried. Rich? No, all together. I'm sorry? They had her attorney had argued that they were harmful to her. you know, made her look bad.
So,
yeah, the jury didn't see it. So the jury didn't actually see the names, but they saw everything else. And you know, there was other evidence that tied Jessica into the activity, like financial records and things like that, registrations. So Richard, he registered and created sites. He gets the IPs, brings up new circuits, changes IPs, and updates RoboMail, deals with Daniel. Richard pays all bills. And you see all references to Richard were scratched out. And here's some, well, I don't know if you can see this, but RoboMail version 3.2.1, he says defers 17%, while 2.10.13 only defers 0.5%. So the older version was actually a better version, and that was actually the version that we saw running previously. Get tons of IPs, figure out filters, figure out AOL. Here's some of the assets he had. He had a 34-foot Stingray, or Sea Ray, sorry, boat type thing, $48,000. A company that he had was worth $9.5 million. And some other investments that he had were $4.1 million. A lot of this stuff was overseas. So if you look at his merchant credit card account, this is the problem with spam. People buy the stuff. People buy the erectile dysfunction drugs. People buy the spy sweeper. People buy the anti-malware, spyware products. If people didn't buy these products, or if we published a list of names, you know, and put it in a full-page ad of the Washington Post or what, New York Times, and said, Joe Bob and all of these other people bought penis pills from this spammer, they would never do it. But people believe that if you buy it off the internet, that it's probably legit, or due to one reason or another, don't want to buy it in a legitimate chain of product. So he was generating just this one merchant credit card account during June 2003. He had over 10,000 sales, which were at $40 a pop, about $440,000 a month. His chargebacks were $332,000 per month. So he had $108,000 gross profit per month just on this particular product on this particular credit card account. So he was making some serious money just sending spam and people buying the product. So he was convicted of the three counts of the Virginia Computer Crimes Act in November 2004. He is sentenced to 9 years in prison. Jessica, she got sentenced to, I'm sorry, she wasn't sentenced. She was only recommended a $7,500 fine by the jury. She ended up flipping on her brother. So the judge decided to throw her conviction, to dismiss her conviction. Richard Rakowski, however, walked out. The day they said, Jeremy James, we find you guilty, sentencing will happen at a later date. And so he was distraught. Jessica, we're going to sentence you. You're guilty. We're going to sentence you later for a fine. And then Richard, they said, you're free to go. And in the courtroom, he stood up, was shocked, ran out of the courtroom, literally ran out the door. So he is currently under house arrest. And he appealed to the Virginia Court of Appeals, and the Virginia Court of Appeals affirmed the lower court's ruling. However, it's currently on appeal to the Supreme Court of Virginia. Most likely, they're not going to overturn it. If he was to, after everything's processed, you can see him probably going to jail in 2008. And all this time that he's spending in his appeals during house arrest is not going to count towards his 9 years. So he'll still have, at the end of it, 9 years to serve. So this is, it's a great case for law enforcement and for the state of Virginia, because we actually have a person who is being, he's going to go to jail for spam, not for fraud, not for credit card abuse, not for compromising computers, straight up spam. Yep.
Did they seize his $10 million company? I mean, for example, is he going to get 9 years, and then after that he's going to have $10 million?
Well, they were able to seize what the government was able to seize what they were able to find. Now, if he had things offshore that they weren't aware of and he didn't tell them about, you know, they couldn't find it, yeah, after 9 years, he may have money waiting for him when he comes out. But the actual things that they were able to show that he bought with the profits, like his house, the condo, the cars, the boats, things like that, those are gone. But any money that's overseas, any money they were able to get, they took it. But anything he has overseas, yeah, 9 years later, it's waiting for him. So, yep. Yeah. He offered downloads and different products. So, yeah, when the consumer received the product, they, if it didn't work, they charged it back. You know, they called their credit card company.
Almost 75% charged
it back. Right.
But were they able to prove that the products he was selling,
it didn't come up in the case because that wasn't, it wasn't a point that he was engaging in consumer fraud. If they wanted to have that charge, then yeah, they would have to analyze the software and see what he was doing, but that wasn't kind of the point of the case. The point of the case was he's a spammer. It doesn't matter what he's selling. He could be selling, you know, baby powder. It doesn't matter what he's selling. Ice cream, yeah. It doesn't matter. So, sure. He was not using a botnet. He had different IP space. So, Christopher Smith. I don't know if any of you have heard about him, but he's my personally favorite spammer of all time because he's in. It's a very interesting story. Also on Roxo, had multiple aliases, including Rizzler and Robert Johnson. 26 years old. He has been in the business of spam since he was in high school. He dropped out of high school, decided this is what I want to do. Extremely, extremely smart. In 2001, he was ordered to pay $60,000 in damages to Time Warner Cable for selling cable decoders. They didn't like that too much. They ended up seizing all of his product at the time, cleared out his warehouse, took all the cable decoders and descramblers out. So he was also shipping product. In 2002, Time Warner Cable obtained an injunction barring him from selling those descramblers through email. In 2004, AOL filed a case against him for sending spam emails that advertised human growth hormone, erectile dysfunction pills, things like that. Due to law enforcement also conducting a concurrent investigation, they had to refile their case in 2005. And at that, in 2006, that case came to a close, and he was ordered to pay $5.3 million. $25,000 for every day that he spent sent spam emails, which was a canned spam violation, plus $287,000 roughly for legal fees to AOL.
Not yet.
And I'll tell you why he hasn't paid everybody. In 2004, in the middle of this AOL case, this is when the law enforcement got involved, he established an illegal online pharmacy business, originally filling orders by importing drugs directly from India. Then he switched to a U.S.-based pharmacy to fill orders after enlisting a physician to issue sham prescriptions. So the people were receiving legit product when he switched to a U.S.-based pharmacy. He lied to multiple small pharmacies. He said, yeah, I'm running this legit operation. I'm trying to get the products for refills. So he was indicted on 14 counts initially. There are two other indictments. So the third superseding indictment revised the counts in September 2006 to 9 counts. However, when he first learned of the government investigation, he expanded his operations into Canada. And the feds didn't really like that too much. His online pharmacy operations played a part in 2 overdoses for one addict client, which required hospitalization. This particular addict testified at this case and said, yeah, I bought drugs for him because they were easy to get. I needed to get pain pills, and I couldn't get them from a regular doctor, so I bought them through his online pharmacy. And yeah, I went to the hospital twice because I OD'd, but still, he has a great supply, you know. So it's very interesting. Within days of his 2004 court hearing, his 2005 court hearing, he flew to the Dominican Republic and established another online pharmacy. So he got indicted. Then he flew to the Dominican Republic, set up another organization or set up another pharmacy. And then when he came back, the feds weren't too happy about that. The court placed him on electronic monitoring and prohibited him from going near a computer, owning a computer, PDA, anything that has access to the internet, or facilitating any web page companies or any startups, anything that had to do with the internet. And so for a time, he was released to a halfway house, and within the first month of being at the halfway house, they caught him with a laptop and a PDA. And he admitted to the judge that he was setting up a search engine optimization website. So they weren't happy with that. So they put him in jail. And while he was in jail, he misused other inmates' IDs. For you to make a telephone call in jail, you need to have an identification number. And when you communicate with your attorney, those calls are not recorded. However, he misused other people's IDs so he could get past the recording aspects. He even had one of his co-conspirators, who was an attorney, set up a telephone number to be listed on the attorney list so that he could have unrecorded communications to continue his business from jail. He also found a list of known attorney telephone numbers and then looked for ones that were defunct and no longer coming to the courthouse. He contacted a voiceover IP company, got that telephone number that was already on the list, and used that to continue to conduct his business. He also arranged to have Xanax snuck in for him so he could deal with his anxiety of being in jail. After a while, the feds found out about this after the Xanax incident, and they decided to let him continue, but to go ahead and record his calls and find out what he was trying to do. And what he was trying to do is talk to one of his conspirators in the Philippines to arrange a hit on a witness. Not only was he trying to arrange a hit on a witness, he was also trying to arrange a hit on his wife and his wife's boyfriend. So he was a bad guy, did not enjoy being in jail, but he definitely wanted to continue his activities and didn't want anybody to stop him. Didn't matter who it was. So it's very, very interesting, the motivations that they have to do this. In November 2006, a jury found Smith guilty on all 9 counts. Count 1, conspiracy to distribute and dispense controlled substances. I mean, he was selling hydrocodone, Vicodin, major controlled substances. It wasn't just Xanax or Ambien. It was serious. Counts 2 through 4 were unlawful distribution of and dispensing of controlled substances. Counts 5 through 7, introduction of misbranded drugs into interstate commerce. Count 8, conspiracy to commit money laundering. And count 9, continuing criminal enterprise. Count 9 is the one that they weren't too keen on. You know, when you're in jail, continuing your criminal enterprise. Do you notice anything missing from these counts?
Oh, yeah.
Spam. They did not go after him for the spam. They went after him. You know, DEA came in, controlled substances, fraud, interstate commerce, money laundering. Most spammers don't get caught on spam. They get caught. The big one is not paying their taxes. The tax man will come and get you. But yeah, fraud, money laundering, that's what they usually get nailed on, because the feds don't have the resources. Not that they don't care. They do care. They don't have the resources to investigate every spam case. A lot of ISPs prepare wonderful criminal referrals, work with a lot of with the FBI, with United States Postal Inspection Service, but they just the law enforcement doesn't have the resources to go after every criminal spam case. That's why they push back to the ISPs and say, if you've got a good case, file a civil suit. So in August 2007, Smith was sentenced to 30 years in prison, 5 years of supervised release upon release from imprisonment, and had to pay an $800 special assessment to the Crime Victims Fund. He forfeited his interest in his Rolex watch, his assorted vehicles, which included Ferrari, a Jaguar, a Hummer, a Cadillac, a BMW, a Mercedes, a Lamborghini, and 2 houses, and his money that was in the U.S., which he had several million dollars. When he heard that he was guilty before sentencing, he actually threw up in the courtroom. He did not expect to go to jail. So, go ahead.
$800 for the special victims on what?
I spent
2.5 million.
Well, it's a special assessment that they have, this general crime victims fund. Anybody who was affected by his pharmacies can file a civil suit against him.
To get
$800. Well, no. To get a piece of whatever he has left. So that's different. I mean, go ahead.
So where did whatever he had left go? All the cars.
They sold it.
Okay.
The feds have taken a lot of the money. Obviously, you've got to pay attorneys and things like that. They seized it. They took it all. So he is my favorite because of just the drama behind him. I mean, it was literally a soap opera.
Why did you come back to the U.S. from the Dominican Republic?
Okay. Can I? Okay. He came back.
The microphone's right there.
Okay.
We're recording this, so if you got a special story that you don't want to publish, do you want this recorded or not recorded?
No, that's all right.
Okay, let me bump it off.
Hold on.
Okay. He went to the Dominican Republic to set up another pharmacy.
Okay, so I appreciate you guys listening to my story off mic. So the future of spammers, what do we see now? We see people from Eastern Europe. You hear about this. I don't know how familiar you are with the current spam botnet situation. You hear things like, oh, it's this mysterious, you know, Leo Kuvayev, this mysterious Russian, you know, who's running this Russian spam gang. Or you hear, oh, it's this, you know, it ties back to an old spammer, Alan Rowski. It's Al Rowski. It's definitely Rowski. But the thing is, this is the future of spammers now. It's not a one-man show or a one-man organization. You know, this is spamming now and phishing. I mean, they don't just do one type of activity. They engage in spam. They do phishing. They do other kinds of fraud, credit card theft. They cash out these cards. They sell the cards. So you're looking at organized crime that's coming out of Estonia, Romania, Moldavia, Russia. You see that they're getting drugs from India and China and other places in Eastern Europe. I showed you guys a slide, or I'm sorry, not a slide. How Viagra spam works. It's my background. An email recipient clicks on a link. It takes them to a web page, which is it's a disposable hosting site. So that could be a compromised website, it could be a compromised website on a compromised server. It could be a compromised computer in a botnet that's a record. They're actually doing the hosting of the site. And that information goes back to the spammer. It's an affiliate program. So those people that are compromising those websites get paid a piece. Those people who are offering up their botnets are getting paid. The spammer gets paid based on his affiliate codes. And then that gets pushed through a merchant account. Obviously, you got to pay for the transaction has to go through somehow. Somebody has a merchant account. And then somebody's fulfilling orders. So you've got all these different people. You've got people who compromise machines, people who obtain credit cards or obtain identities to get additional merchant accounts, or people who have legitimate merchant accounts that they're using. Most of the time, they want to get domestic-based merchant accounts because that gives them the ability to process Visa and MasterCards with less problems. If you're an international bank an international company, or you've got an international merchant account, banks are going to look a little bit harder at you because of the Patriot Act and terrorism and funding those types of activities. So what they do is a lot of times they will set up a business in the U.S. through an incorporating service, so they don't actually live here. They send some guys some money and some information. Maybe they'll even photocopy their ID. Most of the time they don't need to. And that company, the incorporation company, will file the business, and you have now a legitimate business entity so that you can go to a U.S. bank and say, I have a legitimate U.S. bank or U.S. company. Now I want to have a legitimate merchant account. Sometimes these people buy stuff called shelf companies, where these incorporation companies will go out and incorporate generic names across the U.S. Or they may buy companies that are now defunct, but they have some sort of history of existing. You know, they've been around for the past several years. So when a bank does research on them, they go, yeah, this company was incorporated back in 1997. You've been around. We feel safe giving you an account. You know, or they come up with some sort of lie, or you know, there's always social engineering involved. So it's an organized criminal syndicate, and it's just finding their domestic touches that tie back to them. And it's surprising how many people in the U.S. facilitate that activity. And if you come down on them, you know, they do flip and tell you where it's all happening overseas. So it's not impossible. by them saying, oh, it's Russian spammer, Russian gang. No. You can find out that the man behind it may be in the U.S. Facilitators or enablers of the different services are in the U.S. You can get them. You can nail them on everything, you know, the fraud, the spam, because they're co-conspirators. So it's a conspiracy claim. So I forgot to mention this at the beginning. I'm actually not an attorney, so don't misconstrue anything that I said as legal advice. But you know, these are the things that we see, you know, every day. It's never a dull moment in my office. You know, I've seen everything from child pornography, bestiality, phished credit cards, obviously hacked networks, personnel information from major companies. I mean, there's all kinds of activity that's going across the internet, and that is if it has a value to you as a business person, it has a monetary value out on the internet. Surprisingly, your identity, like your credit card information, let's say your credit card information, your name, the CVV, and the expiration date, it's worth about $1.50. That's it. In a Carter form, about $1.50, depending on where your bank is and how much your how much balance you have or how much credit you have. Just your credit card information, not your full identity, not your social and everything, but just that one piece of it, $1.50. Now, it costs me a lot of money to clean up a problem like that. I mean, it costs the consumer, it costs a bank a lot more than $1.50. But, you know, they use your cards to buy registration, you know, they have domain names. They use it for, I mean, you name it. They've used your card for it. Yes?
How likely is it if someone steals your credit card number and name and address or whatever, and then uses it
held liable?
Held liable, prosecuted, or indicted on any.
I'm actually going to talk about this tomorrow afternoon. So if you guys would love to come to my cyber fraud preventing being phished presentation, I'd be more than happy to go in depth about it. But just to tell you, we see a lot of compromised cards, compromised accounts. You can tell by the activity, the way the card was used, whether or not there was a chargeback. That's the big one. If you've charged back that particular transaction, or you've put a fraud alert on your account or on your credit report, those are the things that we see as well when we issue a subpoena. We know this was a compromised card. So we're not likely to go, really and sincerely, not going to go after a victim. There's no reason to. Now, we may contact a victim and say, did you have any other charges? Have you noticed any other unusual activity? And that's what's really important, is getting that feedback and saying, yeah, they used my card for this, this, and this, these different transactions. I've also seen some weird things on my identity, you know, like on my credit report, somebody did these other things. So we know what they've, whether or not they had your credit card or they had your whole identity. How big of a chunk of your life are they affecting? And it helps us figure out what their criminal operation is. Are they just stealing identities? You know, are they using you for other things? My biggest concern would be if I had my identity stolen and they did something really bad with it, getting on a no-fly list, because that's hard to get off of. I actually had somebody, I had a credit card that I used one time. I just got it. I used it on Woot.com, which, as far as I know, they haven't had a data breach. I'm not saying that they have, because I have no idea. And then I went to go check my balance online, because I do it all the time, and I saw a pending authorization for about $1,500 and some spare change for 1-800-Flowers.com. How many bouquets of flowers do you need to buy? I contacted the credit card company, told them that there was a fraudulent charge, and the original person I spoke to, she said, oh, that's a ghost charge, don't worry about it. I'm like, no, it's not. I mean, it is a ghost charge if you guys are just going to kick them out. But it's not a ghost charge to me, and not to my card. That proves that it's been compromised in some way. I called back and spoke with their fraud department, and they canceled the card, you know, listed it as stolen. And then I contacted 1-800-Flowers, and I said, do you have any information on this particular transaction? Did you log the IP when they came in to initiate this transaction? did this actually get sent out? Did they buy, you know, 100,000 flowers and ship them? I mean, what happened? And they said, the address information, we don't store it. They don't have it. They didn't. If it's not a legitimate charge and the order is not legitimate, and their key phrase for legitimate order is if the address doesn't check with UPS, in other words, if they're unable to send the actual product, then it's an invalid order and it gets kicked out of their system and they don't keep the records. So what they believe happened was that they were just running my card through their system using their pre-auth process to see how much credit I had on my card. Obviously, I had at least $1,500 because that order went through. Well, the order pre-authed. So they got an email that said, okay, we just need to check the rest of your information, but as far as we can tell, this order will go through. And then because the address information was incorrect, the order didn't go through. So it's interesting. Go ahead.
Well, you are a victim. You do request information that you did. How agreeable are the companies to releasing it to you? And what kind of evidence do you have to provide?
It depends on the company. A lot of the times, if I was very persistent, but that's what I do for a living. You know, I'm persistent and I'm a pain in people's, you know, I'm a thorn in their side, and that's what I do. I engage in data collection.
So also, what kind of leverage can you use to encourage them to release information?
You can get like a letter from your bank or your credit card company that says we find this charge to be fraudulent. Call them, you know, ask to speak to their fraud department. They most likely know that it's going on and that it's not just you. It's not usually a one-off like that. So you can get information from your bank, get information from your credit card people. I would also report it to the IC3. And this is, I have all these wonderful sites that I'll talk about tomorrow for fraud. And it also depends how they got your card. There are some banks that are now saying they are saying it and they're not saying it. I mean, they're putting this idea forward that if your computer, if you've suffered a loss due to malware on your system, and you've reported it to them as fraud and you said that you've cleaned up their system, they're willing to write it off. However, if your system isn't cleaned up and you continue to have you have a keystroke logger on your system or you're continued to be compromised, that after a while, they're going to say, you know, we're not responsible for this anymore. You need to take this into your own hands and deal with it because you've got a compromised system. Now, of course, a bank doesn't want to have to do that, but they can't continue to take these losses. So, you know, it's just how it works.
In terms of international agreements and working arrangements, you mentioned in terms of prosecuting scammers, you can go after local conspirators or American conspirators with merchants and players, watch like that. What does the jump look like when you try to continue the prosecution overseas to Estonia, the Moldavia, Russia, things like that?
This is where criminal referrals come in handy. You want to refer. There's different approaches. One approach is, let's say you have a company that's affected. Let's say a pharmaceutical company, because their drugs are being advertised through the spam. That pharmaceutical company may have an international presence, and so they may be able to file a civil suit in that country.
Like Pfizer.
Something like that, right. So if they have a presence in that country, they can file a civil suit. But a lot of times what ends up happening is you're working with law enforcement on your side to work with law enforcement on their side, and that's a very slow process. You know, like in China or in Russia, you may refer this to the FBI or the DEA, and they'll work with their FBI legates overseas to facilitate this. The key thing there is, if they're engaging in that criminal activity overseas, they're probably not paying the tax man over there either. And if you inform the tax division over there, a lot of times they'll knock down the door before their local law enforcement will, because they want their peace. So there are different ways you can work with them. You can work with Interpol. You can work with the Chamber of Commerce. There's a lot of different entities out there for a company, an ISP, or any corporate entity to work with. As an individual, obviously, you're not going to file an anti-spam suit. I would highly suggest that you don't, because there have been a lot of cases that have been not handled well because you don't have the funding that a corporate entity does. The best thing you can do is gather the information and submit it to your ISP, or submit it to, like if it's a malware situation, submit it to Lawrence Baldwin at Minet Watchman, or to Lance James at Secure Science. I mean, there's a lot of people who are in this activity who are working with the corporations. And if you can submit that evidence, or even say, look, I know my system's compromised, you can use my system to get the malware to inject into the botnet. Use my system as an undercover machine. That's extremely helpful. Yes.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
GANSPAN Act. You have to detect that they try to send out a certain number of spam emails in a certain day.
Mm-hmm.
What if they're using a botnet and they're simply getting an entity outside the country to send the spam for them?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they still can.
But then can you prove that this person sent those 25,000 emails? He could say that, no, I just sent this one email to guy X who sent 25,000 emails on my behalf. Well, he won't say on my behalf, but that's what happened.
That's a lot of the investigative process. You need to go through. This is where people like Lance and Lawrence come in handy, because they may have machines that are in the botnet. So they're able to see the traffic and see how much spam's going through, and tie it back to the mailing software that initiated it, or ties it back to the command and control IP. And there, by monitoring, and also ISPs can do this too with NetFlow, where they're observing the actual traffic that's going across their network. You know, there's a lot of different ways that ISPs and different botnet technical advisors, you know, people who are very well versed in the construction of a botnet and the way they operate, and they can work with attorneys who are representing corporations to be able to build this and say, yeah, look, I can show you. You want to see the traffic right now? He's doing it right now. And you don't need. The thing is, if they show up in court and say, I only sent one email, it's kind of preposterous. They don't show up in court most of the time. You know, they don't. If they're going to admit they sent one email, you know they sent more than one. And most of the time, we don't bring a case. Actually, we've never brought a case where we only have an example of one email. I mean, these are bulk emails. These are tens of thousands to millions of emails.
I guess it only works if this person personally used RoboMail or some equivalent mass mailing software.
They can use. I mean, they have to mail it somehow. There's a lot of malware that has a mailing component in it now. So they can just set it and forget it. You know, if they have a botnet, they made sure that this malware was on there. They rented the botnet for that time period and that malware for that time. So there's a lot of that discovery can do. You know, you find somebody behind the botnet, you know, the command and control, you send a subpoena for that IP, you find out who that person is or that company, you find out who their customers are. There's a lot of different ways you can get to identity. And the most important thing isn't, well, let's fix all these computers. It's let's get to the root of the cancer, find the identity, and haul that person into court. That's what's most important. That's what needs to be done, and it is being done. It's just there's a lot more being done on the defensive than the offensive. You know, most ISPs spend millions of dollars a year on filters and blocking mechanisms and spend very little on enforcement because they believe that let me take that back. They don't necessarily believe, but they feel that law enforcement can do it more effectively when law enforcement is overwhelmed. So there's a part they can play as well. You had a question?
Who are these companies who are creating this software?
It's a lot of smart people. I mean, it's not like HP has RoboMail. You know, it's not like that. I mean, these are programs that are developed by individuals for that express purpose. Open source software. You know, there's why do people write viruses? You know, it's the same.
Have they gone after any of those
people? They have. Not many of them, though.
Just a half a page of code, which takes like half an hour to write that code, like more like 10 minutes to write.
Yeah. If you just want a dirty piece of code that's going to send, not, if you want it pretty with this interface and make it real easy for anybody to send spam, you have RoboMailer or any other dark mailer or something like that. But there's, anybody can write code to send, you know, to check a list of compromised machines and use this particular vulnerability or over certain ports or what have you. I mean, if you want to send spam, you could find the person to technically send it for you. It's not difficult. Yes.
A little bit off topic.
Sure. Technically, that AT, they shouldn't be charging you for that. Well, the faxes, I don't actually know off the top of my head the particular U.S. code that covers faxes, but there is a law against faxes. It's just people don't file junk fax laws. And,
but it's a federal law for all 50 states?
I believe so, yes. And there's a lot of people who do individual cases. Like, if you could prove that they sent you this junk fax, you get $500, you know? So, I mean, it happens often, but you don't hear companies. Like, I get junk faxes every day advertising stock spam. Well, it's junk faxes, so fax spam. But I get that all the time. But it's not worth my energy to go hunt that person down and file this tiny little case personally against this guy who's sending me faxes. Back in the day when faxes were really expensive, people did. You know, there was a cause. There was a reason for it, but you're not going to get millions of dollars because somebody sent you a junk fax. But on the other hand, political speech is protected. There's also, canned spam doesn't define what type of speech. I mean, it says commercial emails, but there are situations where nonprofits send email that can be considered commercial. And there was a recent opinion in a case where a union had sent union organizing emails to people, and they were misrepresenting their identity. They ended up settling, but the judge did have an opinion that was published, and if you want more information about it, I will be more than happy to send you the case information. But who did say, you know, this may be considered spam. I'm not going to dismiss this case. The union organizer said, let's dismiss this case. This isn't spam. We're nonprofit. And the judge said, no, this could be spam. And that, the fact that the judge said, wait a minute, I'm not going to throw this out because you guys may be engaging in spam, is a good sign. And I think definitely with the upcoming elections and the fact that a lot of candidates are using the internet, using YouTube, you're going to start seeing cases come up where so-and-so sent, you know, Democrat here, X sent an email pretending to be the Republican candidate to the Republican's constituents that was negative. You know, there's a lot of ways where political speech, they're hiding, not necessarily hiding behind political speech, but that protection of political speech that can still be considered harmful. And we just haven't had any cases of that. I would not be surprised if we see something like that happen. So keep your eyes open. This next election, you'll see, I bet you we're going to see a whole lot of political spam. It's going to be good to watch. So, any other questions? I have two books here, so if anybody has an insightful question or something that stumps me to the point where I have to go excuse myself and get you the information later, you have an opportunity to either get Secrets and Lies, which is a very good book, or The Art of Deception by Kevin Mitnick. Now, you get your choice, so... Any good questions? Yes.
Let's just say this is purely theoretical and hypothetical, okay? We've never actually heard anybody do this.
Right.
But there are a lot of distributed processing programs like SETI and protein folding and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what if someone created programs like that people trusted and could install on their computer?
Right. That looked friendly.
Right. Well, no, this is, they are friendly.
Okay.
For our purposes.
Okay.
And
mm-hmm.
and find the IP addresses of people of systems that are sending spam, you know, all these distributed programs can do a denial of service to that server.
That was trying.
They got sued, put out of business.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're attacking. Your Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Computer
vigilantes. Exactly. You have to. Oh, okay. It was. It happened. I mean, a lot of this stuff you don't see people doing jail time for. I mean, it gets settled out of court, obviously. The thing is, those people are victims as well. You know, you don't want to go after these people's computers and do harm to them. Again, this is something I'm going to talk about tomorrow, but...
It's not a person's individual box. They still have to go through their ISP. So if you shut down their ISP, it'll encourage the ISP to be more vigilant.
It doesn't.
There's a website called Artists Against 419 mm-hmm. do that, and they have a program called Lab Vampire, which they identify the fake banks
mm-hmm.
and people's money. And they have a web page that you can go to with, I think it's a Java component on it now, that just relentlessly hits that server with every good ounce of bandwidth you have. It takes them down.
Yeah, and the thing is, this is affecting the ISP. I mean, the ISP views this as a straight-up attack. It's not a nice thing to do.
They only usually do that after the ISP has been contacted and is shown to be unresponsive.
But that doesn't give you the right to... engage in the same activity. I mean, here's an example, the Stormworm. Don't know how many people are familiar with this, but lately people have been receiving spam that's like, hey, dude, check this out. And it's a YouTube link, but it's not a YouTube link because it actually goes to an IP address that has malware on it that installs onto your system and make it compromise your machine so that it becomes part of a botnet, which is also used to send spam or to do denial of service attacks. Which it's currently doing because any investigator who tries to investigate these computers that have been compromised with Storm, and if they're doing multiple scans on the system, they get attacked by the whole botnet, not just by that computer. And it's taking down really important people. Well, at least I think they're important in the industry. So, I mean, people are thinking, well, let's use our power of these systems. Let's reverse a botnet. Let's do this. But the thing is, we have these laws in place to protect ourselves. There has to be a better way than just slamming an ISP. We need to convince ISPs to change their policies and procedures and to understand that, just like spam a long time ago, this does affect your ROI. A lot of people say, oh, with botnets, these compromised machines, it doesn't affect our cost center. We don't see it being a problem. Well, it's a problem if people are complaining. It's because they can't calculate it. No, I mean, how do you calculate how much a compromised machine costs their network in bandwidth, in storage, in traffic, in customer calls? That's hard to quantify. And that was the same argument people had with spam. Well, I don't see how it affects us. And then once people did studies and started evaluating, this is how much it costs you in both hardware, software, people, and your customers, then they realize, oh, it is a problem. So it's not working with your tech end. I mean, people in the abuse departments and IT departments know how it affects you, how it affects everybody. It's the fact it has to get up to the CEOs. And a lot of times, technical people and managers don't speak the same language. So you need a translator, and that's where attorneys can come into play, especially technical consultants or attorneys who have technical consultants who understand the technical components and what those costs are going to be and can translate it to management and say, okay, this is how you solve your problem. If you can bring down their costs or, you know, bring their profits up, they're more than happy to implement any measure that can do that. So, yes?
So where do you see things in another
5 or 10 years? I think we're on the precipice of going either way. If companies don't start paying attention to the botnet problem, I mean, it was the big 2001 through 2003, the hot word was spam. Then it was phishing. And now it's botnets. And we're always behind, always behind. Storm is a big example of something that can really wreak havoc on the internet in general. It's working to, it's literally getting ISP, cross industries, getting trademark holders, because trademark holders have the ability to file an ex parte motion to allow them to freeze and seize assets. Before you even give the guy notice, you can actually petition the court to freeze his assets, to seize his computers, so you can analyze what's going on, and he doesn't move his money offshore. So there are trademark holders that have the ability to get involved, like luxury good manufacturers, you know, Rolex watches that are being advertised, drugs that are being advertised. Pharmaceutical companies have a trademark claim. They need to work with ISPs, and ISPs need to work with law enforcement and need to work with mail filter companies. Right now, I mean, God love them, they're spending the money and they're making this technology so that ISPs don't all have to do it in-house. They can contact CloudMark, Brightmail, Ironport, whoever, and give them a solution and tailor it to them. However, how long are they going to pay that multi-million dollar price and still get hit with spam? They're going to need to upsell and offer additional services for these companies and say, you know, hey, not only are we blocking and filtering for you, we're going after guys. And that's where I think that's where it needs to move. Mail filter companies, ISPs, trademark holders need to come together and push this forward and make kills and say, I've got that guy. We got this person. See, this can be done. It's not all overseas. And then work with their international counterparts and train them appropriately so that we've got this communication that's going across multi-industry, and they can share the cost. If you're splitting it across, you know, 100 different companies, the cost is relatively small compared to one ISP having to bear the burden. So,
what's going to be the ultimate solution to this? Because, I mean, with technology, it's almost like any petty criminal on the street has an atomic bomb to use in society. I mean, do we need, like, some sort of an escape from New York sort of scenario so we'd be like, take these people and drop them in the middle of the wilderness or something? I mean, because, I mean, these are obviously pathological people who are not going to stop. This is a psychological problem.
It's picking them off. I mean,
with a sniper?
It's funny you bring that up, because my boss actually talks about that. I mean, he says that all the time. Do we need to drop a bomb in a certain area?
I mean, or do we need to start hanging them on primetime TV or something? You know? I would pay to see that.
Oh, don't bring that up. I could talk all day about that To Catch a Predator stuff. Anyways. It's observing geopolitical boundaries. If, like, for example, an ISP. I mean, I come from an ISP background, so that's why I'm saying ISP. I don't want you to think that I'm, you know, knocking on ISPs, because I think they do a great job when they have the resources. Obviously, there are ones that don't care, but for the most part, the big ones are doing what they can. ISPs can start observing those borders. If all of a sudden, you know, we just don't want anything from Nigeria anymore. Block Nigerian ISPs. I mean, block Nigerian IPs. There's obviously a problem with that, because businesses get really angry. But right, if your customers say, I don't want any Nigerian anything, block it. Yeah. Block. One thing you can also do is, if you're observing botnet traffic and you're working with people who are injected into botnets, you can set up as an ISP to block the command and control IP, so that command and control computer can't talk to compromised systems on the networks anymore until they change that IP, which is a manual approach, and nobody wants to do that. But imagine you have 100,000 compromised systems that are all compromised by the same malware, and it's all communicating to the same command and control IP, and the botnet owners don't know you know that IP, block it. Now all of your customers, they still have a problem, obviously. They're still compromised, but you're not dependent on them to fix it. You fixed it temporarily. I mean, there's a lot of different ways. There's a lot of different technology that's out there, but it's pushing the limits and realizing what you can do with both civil litigation and the laws that you have at hand and using them. You have these tools. You need to use them. And working with other people outside of your industry, surprisingly, they don't like it either. You know, there are brand issues here. So it's working across the board.
Okay.
Go ahead.
How do you sort of classify spam? Is it just like spam cells, like all these so-called products which really don't work, as opposed to just unsolicited email? Say, I went to this company, they are a real company, I bought their product, and they required me to sign up on their website and give me their email address.
Mm-hmm.
Now they send me an email every week saying that, oh, please buy a product. I just bought that one product from them, and it gets really annoying to get one email every week.
Well, that's...
Well, this is Cartoon Vistaprint, right?
Vistaprint.
They call it too, don't they?
Well, that's where CAN-SPAM has the transactional and relationship message aspect. The thing is, when you sign up for something, you need to read the terms of service, and you need to follow the opt-out procedure. You know, if they give you a way to get out of these mailings, you have to go through that process. That's what CAN-SPAM set up for you. If you choose, and there's a case that's out there that didn't go well for this person, but he did not choose. He said, you know what? I don't click on opt-out links because that just causes me to get more spam. I don't want to contact them through the appropriate channels. You know what? CAN-SPAM laid these out. And if you can prove that, yes, I got this spam and I sent them an email that said I want to be using their opt-out procedure, 10 days later, you know, 30 days later, I continue to receive the spam, I continue to contact them, then that's a different case. It's a different situation. But you have to follow the opt-out procedures. Now, that's why a lot of people don't like CAN-SPAM, because they're like, oh, well, this makes it harder for the consumer. But it was a very easy way to say, good marketers over here, bad marketers over there. Now we can refine. We don't need more laws. You know, we need to change policies. And the people that can change those policies are the companies. And the reason why they'll do it is because you as a consumer can say, hey, I'm not going to take this anymore. Don't send me this, you know. And unfortunately, yeah, it takes a little bit of manpower, but it does work. If you want to be on an ISP that cooperates with law enforcement or cooperates with civil enforcers like ILG, like me, or with the FTC, you want to push them to change their privacy policies. Instead of them having a privacy policy that protects everyone, even people that are using their services to engage in fraud, instead of having this one-size-fits-all privacy policy, why don't you say, you know what, we're going to have a strict privacy policy for those who engage in good. If you've been terminated due to, not just on a whim, but established pattern of crime or established complaints, you've been terminated, maybe you no longer are protected by our privacy policy. Why should they continue to protect these people? They shouldn't. They should work with the appropriate authorities without having to jump through subpoena hoops and say, yeah, you told me about Joe Bad Guy. We got him off our network. Here's his information. As far as we know, we're a victim as well. That's one thing, you know, that they can do. They can change their privacy policies and their terms of service to stop protecting these people. And it's a big legal argument. You know, a lot of times they don't want to get into the liability concerns. So it's back and forth. But I think that's changing privacy policies, changing terms of use to protect not only the company's interest, but their consumers' interest as well. So that's what I would say is kind of the next step right now, is changing from within, taking back the internet, not being afraid of these spammers. There are some companies that are like, we won't terminate these people even though we're fully within our rights to, because we're afraid of getting sued. You're afraid of getting sued by somebody who's causing damages to you. You're fully within your rights to terminate that customer. Terminate them. That's their decision to make. That's their business policy. So, hate to say it, it is. Okay. Go ahead. I don't know how I'm doing on time, so I don't want to run over into someone else's session.
You have 15 minutes.
Yeah, I've got two more questions.
I have two more questions? Okay, cool.
In California, we have the Do Not Call List, which apparently is now federal.
Yep.
Is the CAN-SPAM Act the internet equivalent of the Do Not Call List, or does there need to be some more distance to be traveled before something as easy,
like a do not email list,
or do not yeah, like a do not email list.
I would not. I don't think.
Is there too much technical and political blocks in the way for having something that is that easy?
Yes, I believe so. One. Wouldn't you hate it if the government was not protecting their server appropriately and that do not email list became public? Yeah. And we know that that happens all the time, that government computers are compromised. It just happens. Now, that would be a hot commodity on the internet, that do not email list.
That's the way the do not call list works.
Security analog is like,
right. What?
Security analog is like a robust text file.
Uh-huh.
Don't look at these pages.
Yeah, they're not gonna.
You're telling people. I mean, if it gets out there, you're telling people where to email them.
Right. Well, the thing is, legitimate marketers, sure. I mean, legitimate marketers currently get access to the do not call list. They play nice, but the problem isn't the legitimate marketers.
Right.
For the most part, they're doing what they're supposed to. It's the people who are engaging in, you know, illegal activity. Blatant illegal activity. I'm not saying, you know, oh, this is, you know, Hallmark sending me an email that I didn't want twice. I mean, we're talking about somebody who compromised a computer. You know, it's a definite difference. So, any other questions? Go ahead.
So, what about ISPs blocking port 25? The port you need to send.
Right.
What about an idea of the way they use to track credit card spending, where they track exactly the sort of on your credit card, and they won't authorize transactions which they see as out of your regular spending habits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about you use the same sort of idea on 425? If a guy sends like 10 emails a day, all right.
Throttling.
That's exactly what I'm
saying. They do that. Some people do that, yeah.
Not throttling like every week across the board. If you have somebody who really needs to send 400 emails a day and if you're throttling, you'll be very angry. Or if you limit that you just send only one email every 30 seconds, but some people even really like doing it or not. Or, you know, Outlook sometimes will like save all your emails in the Outbox and send them all at once. That's a problem. So how about saying that let's monitor these computers and see how many emails are coming up. And if somebody who usually sends 1,000 emails a day suddenly starts sending 1,000, ban that IP on 425 alone. Drop packets coming from that IP from 425 until things are,
I mean, that approach, I mean, that's been kicked around in before. You've got a lot of different problems. Calls into the call center. That's a big problem. Now, how do you explain that? You've got SOHO, you know, small businesses on residential lines. You know, if you want to say across the board, all residential customers, you can only send out 40 emails at a time. Well, you're going to lose customers because they don't want to pay for business. You've got dynamic IP addressing, which comes into a problem there. If you're going to block that IP and then all of a sudden, you know, it goes to somebody who's allowed to send it, obviously, you know, business IPs are in a separate section than consumer IPs, and you could work it that way, but they haven't found a way of doing that without it just being too much trouble. It's an interesting idea, but I've not seen them implement something like that. So they're trying to find a broader solution, and pretty much it's not about blocking or stopping that mail. I think the ultimate solution is killing the cancer, getting the person, finding the identity, enforcement. Cause them to stop or make it difficult, just plain old difficult to conduct business. If you kick them off of every domestic ISP, that's going to make it difficult for them to continue. Or all of a sudden they're not going to be able to get a merchant account in the US. That's a problem. So it's working on a higher level. It's sharing that data across financial institutions, across registrars, definitely across registrars. And just getting to the bottom of it. I mean, you can't, an ISP can't stop spam on a computer by computer basis. I mean, it's never going to end. They've got to go after the people who are engaging in the criminal activity. There will always be a new technological achievement or another way to send spam or another way to send common spam or to send it over SMS or to send it over telephony. spam is going to continue in every form. So it's just being on top of it and having the policies in place and being open to change. Right now, that's hard to do. So.
I got a Google Alert spam today.
Really? Did you sign up for Google Alerts?
I signed up for Google Alerts for my podcast, and if somebody took my podcast and scrambled it and turned it into spam, and my Google Alert picked it up.
Ugh, that's interesting. But I think we're kind of done for now. I really appreciate you guys coming out. And if you're interested in hearing more about cybercrime and specifically the fraud aspect, I'm speaking tomorrow at 1:30, I believe. Check your schedule. In here. Yes, in here. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.